Charlotte Reed interviewing Frank McCabe, Frank Wells McCabe, for the Oral History Project for the Scoville Memorial Library. The date is September 20th, 1983, and we are recording in the Salisbury Town Hall. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Charlotte.
We have had this date postponed several times, and it's my real pleasure to finally get you here with a machine that works. As you know, the purpose of getting together is to ask you to speak about your life in Salisbury, and specifically about Mount Raga and how it has woven itself in and out of your life over the years. I think you had a birthday party very recently, which I attended. How old were you?
80. On that occasion. Meant that I now passed my 81st anniversary of my first visit to the town of Salisbury, where I came at the age of 6 weeks, but not under my own power, brought by my grandmother.
Where did your grandmother bring you from?
From Brewster, New York, because mother and father were taking a year's delayed honeymoon to go to Europe for a trip, and I was brought to the Wentworth house on Mount Raga by my grandmother and lived there for that summer until my parents returned with her and her cook of long standing, Kate Gallagher, and another nurse. But really, my start with Mount Raga goes back to my fact that my mother, in her teens, visited her first cousin, Harriet Wells Warner, at Lotus Lodge.
What year would that have been?
Well, she was born in 75, so it was about 1890, mm-hmm. 1892.
Right.
And her Warner cousins, who were in a different generation, the girls and the boys, but very close to her age, because her father, Frank Wells, had been 20 years younger than his oldest brother, who was the father of cousin Hattie Warner.
What year do you estimate that the first Wellses or Warners were up on Mount Raga?
It would have been the father of the cousin Don Warner of my generation, mm-hmm. who first had a camp up there. And so it would have been sometime probably between 1850 and 1870, at a guess.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been on Mount Raga on many occasions, because he was attorney for the Salisbury Iron Company and the Northern Iron Company, once having succeeded the other, which had operated the furnace.
Let me see if I have this straight. Don Warner's father was an attorney, and he was what relationship to you?
He was...
An uncle?
No. He was... No, my relationship was with the Wellses.
With the Wellses.
His daughter-in-law was Harriet Wells Warner.
I see.
Who married his son, Donald T. Warner.
The judge.
The grandfather of the Donald T. Warner, who now practices law in Sharon.
Uh-huh. And what are your earliest memories of Mount Raga, your own memories?
When my mother was married, her father asked her what she'd like for a wedding present, and she replied, a camp on Mount Raga. So her mother being one of the third owners of the property, the other owners being complacent, grandfather built her a camp on the upper lake, which she named Wish Come True, in 1905. And we spent all our summers there.
Spent your winters in Brewster, and then...
No, our winters in... We lived in after 1905 in White Plains.
In White Plains.
Although I was born in Brewster, because grandfather ran the little bank at Brewster. So that from 1905 until 19, 44, when I was abroad in the military, I had never missed a summer on Mount Riga.
Mm. Lovely memory. What was it? How many people were on Mount Riga? How many camps were there when you first went up there?
Oh, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11 or 12, at the time of the last census. I helped the census taker, and we discovered that there were 43 due to the families having split up with the passing generations.
And of that 11 or 12 that were there in your childhood, how many were directly related to you, or belonged to people directly related? Was it all Wells's or Warner's?
No. There were a Wells camp of my uncle. It was my grandfather's camp, the Daniels Cottage, built by Lakeville's foremost contractor, Mr. Daniels.
Yes.
Because his wife required summers on Mount Riga because of having weak lungs. And then there was the Warner camp, which was all one camp at that time, but later is one, two, three, four camps now.
Uh-huh.
And the others have split that way. Wish Come True, my mother's camp, is now held by the families of my two brothers and my sister.
Going back, though, to the original 11 or 12, there was a Wells camp, a Daniels camp, a Warner camp.
And the McCabe camp.
McCabe.
And the Schwab camp.
Schwab.
The being the
yes.
other third, one-third owners of Mount Riga.
And the three owners then were the Schwabs, the Wellses.
And the Warners.
And the Warners. And then I assume that the other six or seven were smaller camps and did not belong to either of the three main...
They were varying sizes. Perhaps the nicest of all the camps on the mountain was the camp of Dr. Raymond Clark, which he built in the face of an older structure that burned down, mostly himself with good help of logs, and was the most attractive and is the most attractive building. On a point between Round Pond and Forge Pond.
So that takes care of six of them.
The others were
hunting camps.
Owned by the partnership, as it was then, and were rented to people in most cases who had occupied them for some years.
Mm. All right. Now, when did the Mount Riga group become a formal organization?
It was incorporated, I believe, in 1923 as Mount Riga INC, because of the increasing age of the owners and the need to have a vehicle that could be more easily partitioned.
I see. Now, when the original three families, the Schwabs, the Wellses, and the Warners, bought land on Mount Riga, how many acres did they buy, and how did they divide it up?
They did not buy it. It was acquired by senior Judge Warner, the father of the present Don Warner's grandfather, in order that he was the attorney for the iron company they wished to liquidate, and the one asset they couldn't get rid of was the cutover land on Mount Riga, and so he bought it so that they could go out of business.
How much did he pay for it, and how many acres did he buy? Do you have any idea?
There are many apocryphal stories about it, and the acreage is still in dispute. Even after the sale of some 1,200 acres to the federal government for the Appalachian Trail...
In 1982.
Yes. There is a gap of 700 acres between the town's figure and the corporation's figure as to the acreage.
What is the corporation's figure?
3,600, 3,700 acres.
3,700. Mm-hmm. And the town says 3,000.
No.
They say 44?
43 or 4.
So we don't know the exact date when the present Don Warner's great-grandfather acquired this cutover land.
It'd show here in the town hall, in the records. Yes.
But going back to your early memories, what sort of a road was there up the mountain? What sort of life did you have up there in the summer?
Well, there were three roads that were open when we first started to go there. The road from Ore Hill, up which the ore had been brought to the furnace when the furnace was running, which was the poorest of the three roads. The so-called middle road from Selick Hill, which was at that time the best of the three roads. And the road from Salisbury Center, which had been opened about 1838 under pressure from the merchants of Salisbury Center, who said that all the business was going to Furnace Village because the road was so much better. And that road is steeper, and the middle road is still the best road, although it isn't open for vehicular traffic.
Mm-hmm.
The grades are better.
So when you would go up in the summer, you would go up the middle road?
No, we would come up from Salisbury because we went in wagons owned by Anson Williams, the Salisbury liveryman who lived at the house now occupied by the Morey family.
In other words, across from the town hall here.
That had been, after that was bought by Donald J. Warner and his wife, it was moved back, but it had been an inn originally and was right on the road.
So you would come up from Brewster, what, by train?
The Pittsfield and North Adams Express.
And you would
leave New York at 3:20 and arrive, and sometimes on a morning train, but usually on that afternoon train, Mr. Williams would meet us with a three-seated wagon, drive us over to Salisbury, which was a nice quick run, being level, and then a longer trip up the mountain with stops at many thanking hands to rest the horses.
How long would it take you with the horses to get up to your camp on the mountain?
2.5 to 3 hours.
Would it really? That's a long time.
Well, it was a big wagon, and he was careful of his horses.
I'm assuming that this was enough of a production so that once you were up on the mountain, you didn't come down that often.
No.
Did you come down at all during the summer?
The Lord accepted our going to church one Sunday in the summer.
One Sunday in the summer.
So Mr. Williams would come up on that particular day, and we'd go down to Lakeville to church.
How did you communicate with Mr. Williams?
Oh, people were up and down all the time.
They were, but on horseback?
Father came up from New York every Friday.
I see.
And the train would be met. In fact, in the early days, the power car on the afternoon express was switched to the Central New England line and ran through Salisbury over to Norfolk, where it spent the weekend and then went back down on Monday morning.
Mm.
So you could ride in high style and have your breakfast on the train. And
that's what your father did?
Yes, that's the way they come and go for the weekend.
I'm assuming that when he came for the weekend, he didn't have to go in the big wagon of Mr. Williams's, so he made it a little more quickly up the mountain.
Yes, they had to depend. Well, it depended. Usually there were people for several camps who came up, and he'd meet them all, so they usually did use the big wagon.
Ah, and it took 2.5 to 3 hours to get up there.
From Salisbury.
From Salisbury. That made the weekend a little abbreviated, I would say.
Well, no. Because you came on Friday, you mm-hmm. went down Monday.
Well, I remember going in train. My first train trip was from Lakeville to Salisbury, and I walked home. So I have a vivid memory of that railroad.
Yes.
When you were up on Mount Raga, I'm assuming that you did a lot of water-related activities. And what were your favorite things that you did up there?
I think horseback riding. Father was very fond of riding. His father had been a professional horseman, and so he was brought up with horses. And so that I rode almost every good day. I would ride horseback. The old wood roads were all open. There were plenty of places to ride. You didn't have to go the same road or even on the town roads. And his father liked to have the horses ridden all week so that they weren't too fractious when he came up for the weekend.
And that was, I'm sure, something you enjoyed.
That was my responsibility. If I couldn't get somebody to help me, mm-hmm. and usually you could, by then I would ride one horse in the morning and one in the afternoon so that they were well. well tamed.
And you are, as you and I know, both, you're married to Mary Lee, who was then a Borden, and they had a camp on the mountain.
They, in later years, had the same camp to which I was first brought, the Wentworth Cottage, and behind that was the Sherwood Cottage, named for the families who had lived there in times past, and a third camp they built behind, so they had, having six children and numerous people to help, they needed more space than the ordinary camp.
Mm-hmm.
And they had that camp for a great many years, and later other families, sometimes they didn't want it in the summer, they stayed at home. And being right on the lake, it was nice there too. So it, different families who have, some of whom have come to rest in other places on the mountain, the Collins notably, who have the old Thurston farmhouse on the top of the road to our hill, at one time had the Wentworth camp.
Were there many farms on the mountain in your childhood? How was it different in appearance up there?
Not really farm. There was one farmer who raised vegetables and had cows and had a dairy so that the milk was available to the people who had cottages up there in the summer, and various farmers from local families. One, I remember, one of the Sedams was there, and one of the Ostranders, another one, not George, and Jane, who lived on the mountain where the public beach is now, and various Rossiters. One of the Rossiters was a farmer there for a while, and then after World War I, the Angelo Cantelli, who was the great-grandfather of Rick Cantelli in the bank, was the farmer there. And he, in addition, he was a magnificent cook, because he had been cook to an Italian general division in World War I, and he made the most marvelous sausages and cheeses and other things of that nature.
And did he sell them on the mountain?
Yes, he sold them.
There used to be a store on the mountain in the time of the iron industry, but I'm assuming that when you were a child, there probably was no longer a store.
No, it was just a foundation. It was between the Wentworth and the lake, the dam,
mm-hmm.
and its reputation, perhaps apocryphal, was it was the only store in Litchfield County in which you could buy a made-up silk dress.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah. And, of course, that ties in with the early traditions that there was a good deal of gaiety and entertaining on the mountain when the ironworks was going, because the naval officers would come to approve the products that were bought for the Navy, anchors, cannon and such, and so there'd be a good deal of entertaining for them. And in fact, I think it's a verifiable report that Jenny Lind gave a concert there on one of her
tours. Mount Riga. I had never heard that story before. What other stories have you heard, either verifiable or not, about the early years when the iron industry was flourishing?
Of course, the camp now called Castanoak, right there by the dam, was built for the ironmaster,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Petit, who was brought over about 1805.
From
Springfield, mm-hmm. Cynthia Springfield.
Yeah.
Skilled iron master, and that camp was occupied for many years by the Griggs family, both the grandfather and I think the great no the grandfather and the father of Mrs. Barbara Griggs' husband then,
mm-hmm.
they occupied that camp for a long time. At one time, also, they had rented the senior family.
And that's...
The Griggses had rented the Daniels cottage from Mr. Daniels.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the iron master would live?
That's where he lived. It was a very substantial house with nice interior trim. It was a well-built house. And then there were the other houses at that time. There was the old house on the lake where George and Jane Ostrander lived, which had been formerly lived in by the Sedam family,
mm-hmm.
the the father's name was Colonel Ellsworth Saddam, named after the first Union officer to be killed in the Civil War. He was a colonel of the Zouave Regiment, raised, I think, in New York State.
Well, now, did the Iron Master do most of the entertaining when it was...
That I can't tell you. The records are mostly recollection.
The Brzee family has been associated with the Mount Riga group, haven't they, over the years, too?
Yes, they have lived in that general area. The mother of the present Edward Brzee is what remained in that generation. And David.
Yes.
Those two. Their mother, I think, lived originally in a settlement along the Mount Riga Brook, where there were a few houses. And I remember her telling my mother, in my hearing, that she had to get up at 5 in order to walk to Oskis, where she had a job.
Oh, my heavens. That must have been quite a trek. Now, as the years went on, I assume that some work was done on the road, because as a child, I remember the road down to Salisbury as being quite a dangerous...
Yes, well, when automobiles began to be allowed on there about 1918, it became dangerous.
When it was
only horses, it was controllable, but the tendency of people, particularly on a steep road, is to let the car run fast going down. And that has, it's been amazing that there haven't been more serious accidents.
I would agree with you.
We had one this year. I don't recall another.
Over the years?
Over the years. That was really off the mountain. It was down by the lower bridge.
How do you feel about the future of Mount Ragged? I'm jumping around a little bit here, but I just wonder, do you think it is going to be viable to keep this many acres in private hands up there? I know there have been times when the government, both state and federal governments, have...
Yes. The complexion of the present people who do the thinking in Washington, if there is any thinking done in Washington, is that not to spend money for great additional parks. New York State owns the land abutting Mount Riga on the New York State side, except for a little that Mount Riga owns. In the Massachusetts side, not directly up to the state line, but a bit north of it, the state owns some land. On the east side, the federal government owns the land bought within the last couple of years for the trail. And so as long as the thinking of the owners is as it is, the government has it protected in wild state without having any expense.
I see what you're saying,
so,
that by
so
surrounding
it. If the complexion of the ownership changed and they were thinking of development, I think we'd immediately get a response from state and federal governments to prevent that.
Yes, if I see what you're saying,
yes.
That if your heirs and the Warner heirs should have a change of heart, which is...
There are many stockholders now, but most of them have one or two shares more or less acquired because they were people who'd been on the mountain or had camps there, and the controlling stock is still in the three original families.
I'm always puzzled. I gather that if you're a Wells or a Warner or a Schwab, that you don't really own your camp. The land on which it sits.
Four blocks of land owned, three that came out of the corporation when they incorporated and it ceased to be a partnership. Each owning family retained about 7 acres of land, and the Warners had a little before that. So that there are those enclaves that are privately owned, and my grandfather had acquired about 10 acres of land up on the top of the hill, looking down at the lower lake, from other owners that were in the it was never in the corporation. So that there are those bits of land that aren't owned by the corporation.
Averaging about 10 acres each, maybe?
Oh, yes, yes.
Less.
Yes, maybe 10. But there is, of course, in many of the camps are the buildings were sold to the families who had rented them for a long time so that they could have the privilege of maintaining them.
That, and that's what they get, is the privilege of maintaining them.
And they pay a ground rent.
They pay a ground rent?
Yes.
And
to pay the taxes.
To pay the taxes. Mm-hmm. And about, what is the range of the cost of a ground rent if you had a...
I would think today it's gone up because the taxes have gone up with inflation in spite of the very tight management of the town.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe, yes.
$2,000 a year.
$2,000 a year. That's certainly very reasonable.
Yes.
for the lovely...
It just about covers the tax.
Yes. Tell me, what about the question of public use of the swimming area and the campground? What is Mount Raga policy on that?
It's had to change over the years because there are too many people in the world.
I know. What is it? Can you outline what it is now?
No, it is, in a loose way, the maintenance of a swimming area, and I think 4 or 5 places where people can camp overnight over weekends,
mm-hmm.
On the lower lake. And the restrictions on its use, in generally, restricted to people from the Salisbury and the adjacent towns.
Mm-hmm.
But there are exceptions to that because of people who've been doing it since the year one.
Yes.
And naturally they aren't cut off.
Mm-hmm. So that if I were a resident of Salisbury, as I am, and I want to swim up there, I simply go up, and as long as I have a Town Grove sticker or a transfer station sticker...
You have to make your arrangement with Teddy.
I mean just to swim. I can swim without a camp permit. Isn't that correct?
No, you'd have to check with him because you can't get more than so many people at that beach.
I see. Okay, so there is a limitation.
In other words... if you get up to 50 or 60 people,
mm-hmm.
he'll cut you off. You can't say come back another day,
mm-hmm.
because it makes so much noise that carries across the water.
Right.
And it destroys the pleasure of everybody else in the use of it. But most people reserve ahead when they're going to use one of the campsites.
Yes, I know they do that. I just wondered more. The question comes up to me about swimming. There.
Yes. No, I'm afraid that the swimming is not as available as it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because there are too many people
too
who
many
want
people.
To swim.
Right. What about there's no restriction on the use of the pool at the foot of the falls, is there?
That is done by monitoring it.
Mm-hmm.
If you get too many people down there, we throw them out.
Throw them out. Well, I...
Or bring the police into it, because it's only... Most of the people who want to go there are very decent and nice, but every so often you get somebody who wants to have a beer or pot party, and then we rely on our public protector.
Right. Well, I hope that you, over the years, will be able to maintain this rather loose arrangement and not have too many problems with it. Certainly as a citizen, and I think it's been great. Is there any other... I seem to remember as a child there was a small area on one of the other lakes that was also available to the public. Is this true? Well, there was one campsite and a place where you could swim.
No, I don't recall it. Of course, there was an organization, which was a corporation, but had the name of association called the Grassy Lakes Association, that owned land...
On Grassy.
And what they did was under their control.
Mm-hmm.
Grassy is somewhat muddy bottom. It isn't as ideal swimming as the Forge Pond.
Right.
Or Round Pond, for that matter, or the Upper Bay. But as of now, happily... We have acquired a controlling interest in that organization.
I see.
So it will be subject to the beneficent policies of Mount Raga Incorporated.
Well, let's go back a little bit to your childhood on the mountain. Is there anything else that you particularly would like to tell me, which will give other people who weren't able to be there.
We mentioned Anson Williams, who was a great part of the thing. The other great Mount Riga character was David Jones, who was sort of a factotum and in charge of things for old Judge Warner, and also for my grandfather. And he was a man who had a great influence with his fellow men. It's just a matter of character. And he kept order among people who might have a tendency to be unruly. And he supervised the work that was done for people when they had the minor repairs to be made. And I recall there were one family that lived partway down the mountain towards Spore Hill at a place known as Babylon.
Oh.
Just about halfway down to the upper reservoir.
All right. Mm-hmm.
And
beyond the dressers, then?
No. Down the Ore Hill Road.
Oh, down the Ore. Oh, all right. Okay.
And there lived the Taylor family.
Mm-hmm.
And the father and the wife. And the two sons, Hank and Al, and their wives. And while old Dan had been in the Coast Artillery in the Civil War, the family were sort of, I guess they were sort of the predecessors of the Pont generation, that they had. Paragoric was in great demand for people who had to endure the rigors of winter on Mount Riga.
Oh, really? And they got dependent on paregoric?
Paregoric and other things. And it tended to, you'd see a man cutting down a tree and he'd stop suddenly with his axe in midair, and then after about a minute he'd come to and finish the stroke.
Oh, my. This was alcohol or drugs or something?
Paregoric or other things, that painkillers.
Painkillers.
They used to. Remember, the drugstores in the old days were full of bottles of painkillers.
Laudanum and...
And laudanum and alcohol and combinations thereof.
Ah.
And these things got people through the winter on the mountain.
Did David Jones take care of the Taylor group? Or
well,
keep them in order?
Well, they were employed, you see. They'd be doing the necessary chores. They were all expert woodsmen.
Mm-hmm.
And so that he would see to their employment and jobs and check them out. I remember one story, perhaps it's apocryphal, but I think probably not. He was checking tools in my grandfather's tool house shed, and he discovered that the largest monkey wrench was missing. And so old Mr. Taylor was working at that time on the job, and David said to him, "Dan, I was just checking, and I see the major's monkey wrench isn't there." I said, "Don't look at me, Dave. Don't look at me. I don't know nothing about it." "Man," he said, "I don't say you do, and I don't say you don't, but the major's coming up next weekend, and I want that wrench back." "Don't say that to me, Dave," he said. "I don't need that wrench. I've got 12 monkey wrenches to home."
I'm sure all taken from the major and the others. So
he was quite a character. In his youth, he had been both respected and feared.
This is David Jones.
No, old Dan Taylor. Before he
took to drink and.
Well, no, he was always taken to drink. That was a local problem. But always in Salisbury, it's been a problem. there was an old sailor who lived around there and did our jobs. But this is way back, and. He and Dan got in a fight at a place where liquor was sold one night, and the next morning the sailor had disappeared, and Dan was arrested because he threatened the man's life, but there was no evidence, so they let him go. And 3 years later, the old sailor turned up. He'd been so frightened that he'd gone 12 miles north over the top of Mount Washington in the middle of the night.
Oh, my God.
To get away from Dad.
From Dad.
And he was hale and hearty. And so the rumor was put to rest.
Well, there were no liquor stores the way there are these days. Where did...
I don't know how...
How did they get their liquor?
...sold in the town at that time. But a great deal was sold. Mm. As you know, the alcoholic content of the citizens of Salisbury was higher than any town in the state of Connecticut.
I didn't know that. Where'd you get that fact?
Well, it was in the statistics, the federal statistics. I think the average consumption per year was 39 gallons.
Oh, that's an appalling.
That is not a fair estimate of the habits of the people in the town, because there were how many? You know, at least five taverns.
True.
Because this was the first stop from the Hudson River on the way to Boston.
I see.
And so the weary travelers, after having been jolted in a stagecoach, would need a good deal of solace.
So that made the average consumption high.
But I think that in 1839, I believe that was it may have been, in 39 it was 29 gallons or something like that.
Yes, but a high figure.
It's in the federal statistics.
Tell me, what did they drink in those days? Mostly whiskey? Certainly not.
I think rum.
Rum.
Because there was a big trade between New England and the West Indies.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd take down the staples of life, food products, and bring back rum.
Did your family drink rum or whiskey or what?
I think they were very Catholic in their taste. They drank almost anything that was appropriate for the occasion.
But... what about food up on the mountain? Was there a regular trip down to Salisbury?
Yes, there were two deliveries. George Clark's store delivered one day in the week, and Robert's store in
Lakeville
delivered another. And then there was a vegetable man who came up with some regularity in the later years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I said, milk and vegetables were raised by the farmer on the mountain.
On the mountain.
So that... The diet was relatively simple, and then we, when at times we had one very rainy summer. I remember it rained every day in July, and the bridges were underwater. So we would go down on horseback and bring back provisions in a bag.
I'm sure you enjoyed that.
Well, that was it was a necessary chore.
But rather fun, I'm sure. How many, other than the families who owned camps, how many people spent the winter on Mount Riga, would you say, at that point in your childhood in the 1920s or earlier?
Going back in that, say, from 1910, 1915.
Yes.
Well, it was George and Jane Ostrander at the place where the swimming facility is now. And that was an interesting marriage because... She was also his aunt by marriage, having been married to his uncle first.
Oh.
So she was a little older. And she had a very good vegetable garden, and they sold, their peas were particularly good.
And they stayed all winter. What did Mr. Ostrander do? Timber or lumber?
Well, yes. And
lumbering?
Then there was a maple, a sugar bush, up in back of about opposite where you turn to go up Ball Peak, down in there, and he'd make maple syrup, and of course they'd fish, they ate a good many fish, and did other work of that sort.
The fishing isn't particularly good on the mountain now, but it was then, was it?
It was very much better, but of course the soil is just as sour under the water as it is generally through the upper part of the town.
Right.
And so we have made one survey, and we have now under project a survey which will lead to the improvement of the fishing.
You hope to stock it?
No, just to improve the water and the plants so that it'll stock itself.
Oh.
We basically do a little stocking, but we don't. It's good for the water. So that we don't want the pond to go dead.
We know that problem.
Yes.
Well, going back, there would be the Ostranders up there in the winter. How many others?
Then there was old Mrs. Thurston, who lived in the house where the Collin family now are. And she had been Mrs. Rossiter and had lived in a house just above the Wentworth, which is now just a cellar hall. But the well is still used by the people in the Wentworth. And then she married Mr. Thurston. She said to someone, "No point in keeping two fires."
That's a good reason for marriage. Yes.
She was a very nice old lady. I remember her. And then there was the farmer who lived down in the Merritt place, which was down below the cemetery, the road to Lakeville, the That was a good sized farmhouse, mm-hmm. bigger than the others up on top of the hill, and burned down at a later date. And then the house, and that, so there was somebody there, George Ostrander and Mrs. Thurston. I don't think there were anybody.
Any others?
No.
Must have been pretty rugged, I would think, in the winters
yes,
there.
Yes, I think it was. You sort of holed up.
Yes, and didn't see anybody until spring.
You had a barrel of salt in a barrel of ice, mm-hmm. and probably a little mountain veal.
Yes.
And
some venison, probably.
Put down the same way, yes.
Yeah.
And so, and cornmeal and flour. That was about it.
I remember my aunt talking of toboggan parties on the mountain, coming down that mountain road on a toboggan in the 1920s.
My wife's family had a Swiss bob, and we used to use that on that run when after cars were going up there, so you could plow it out a bit so that you didn't slide off on the corners.
Uh-huh. That must have been fun, I think.
Yes, that was a certain amount of hazard.
Yes, well, I'm wondering what else we might include about the mountain that other people would not have been privy to as you were, as far as memories of that time. We've had, in the oral histories, we've had David Brazy's accounts of the hunting and fishing up there. I think yours is very good because it gives us a feeling of those other families that were there, the ones who really held the mountain together as far as the ownership, and I think this is important for us to get on record. I'm going to flip the tape over now, and I'm going to let you collect your thoughts for a minute and see what else you might want to add.